Good morning. It's our Tech Update Monday on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Back with us, Beth D'Angelo. She's worked in information technology for more than 20 years now as a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, otherwise known as DOIT. And we're going to start today with taking a look at your home Wi-Fi, what it is, how to best set it up, get the best signal. And we'll take a look at the web browsers that are available to surf the web and find out the best one for you. And along the way, answering all of your tech questions from the basic to the advanced. What do you need to know to be safe online and to get around online, which is where I feel like increasingly everything is? You can ask your questions, make your comments. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at any time to talk@WPR.org. And Beth, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Good morning, Lee. Thanks for having me.
And let's start with, I guess, a little trivia question here.
What
does Wi-Fi stand for? I can get the wireless part of Wi-Fi. I think I'm pretty sure of that. But the Fi part is what?
I think it's wide fidelity. It's talking about a wide band signal. So do you remember back in the days of Hi-Fi?
Yes.
High fidelity.
So I didn't even get the wireless part right. Why is fidelity?
I believe so. It's wireless fidelity. You're correct. It is wireless fidelity, not wide, but wireless fidelity.
Didn't want to go 0-for-2 right out of the gate this morning.
Wireless fidelity. Yeah.
So, and you know, this has been around for I feel like it's been around for a long time now, like 20 years, which would be a lifetime for technology these days. But how has it advanced in the 20 years that you've been in information technology, Beth?
Well, certainly the consistency and strength of signals has increased over time. The distance that the wireless signals can actually travel, the amount of data that can be transmitted via wireless signals has improved. And then the security around how wireless data is transmitted has really come leaps and bounds.
So when we're talking about Wi-Fi, we're sending these data packets from the internet and from our computer back and forth through the air. How easily can they be intercepted?
Well, it's a radio signal. So without layers of security around that radio frequency wave, it's pretty easy to intercept with the right tools. But one of those major improvements in Wi-Fi has been the encryption that's been built into the devices that are transmitting those signals, so that if the signal is captured, it can't be decoded without very advanced decryption tools.
So, Beth, when I go to connect to a Wi-Fi signal, I always see the padlock or no padlock next to the options there. And the padlock would require a password, and a non-padlock, well, that's just easier to connect to. But what are some of the pros and cons of going from that padlocked wireless connection to the unsecure one?
Yeah, so if you have one that's open, that means it's a public-facing access point. That means anyone can connect to that Wi-Fi router if they're in proximity to it. If they're close enough, they can make a connection to it, which means they are then sharing a network space with every other device that is connected to that Wi-Fi system. So if your system is connected to the same public-facing Wi-Fi as someone who may want to try to get into hack your computer or steal data or, any other nefarious activity, you're not going to be protected because just about anybody who's in proximity to that device will be able to connect to the same network.
So restaurants, doctor's offices, and just about any place you go can have an opportunity for a open, insecure wireless connection. How safe should I be, and what are the best practices when using those connections, Beth?
Yeah, so generally, if I'm on public Wi-Fi, I'm going to be pretty judicious about what I'm doing on my device. So likely, I'm not going to be opening any of my banking apps, opening my personal health data apps, or transmitting anything that could be sensitive or secure information. So I'm pretty careful about when I will connect to an open Wi-Fi signal or a guest Wi-Fi network that's not secured, and really depending on where it is and how many people would have access to it, you just have to be pretty judicious about it. And then also making sure you have the device that you're connecting with has some security built into it. So antivirus protection, if you're really concerned, setting up a VPN on your device will protect your traffic when you're connected to a public-facing Wi-Fi network. So that's another tool you can use. Or just ensuring that all of your applications on your device are password protected with a strong password.
All right, our second trivia question of the day. VPN stands for Virtual Private Network?
That's it. You got it.
I need a ding, ding, ding for getting one right here today.
We need a buzzer for the winner.
But that virtual private network operates in what way, and what's the, what's the purpose of it?
So the way I like to think about it is like a tunnel. Essentially what you're doing is you're connecting to a Wi-Fi network that's open to the public where if you don't have some sort of VPN turned on your device while you're doing that, that signal is interceptable. It's not encrypted. It's easy to intercept with specific types of devices. It could be used for nefarious purposes. If you are using a VPN, you're creating a tunnel within that network that you're connecting to. So let's say that the Wi-Fi network is a large pipe of information that's traveling that anybody can poke a hole into and get access to the data that's traveling through it. But the VPN creates a tunnel inside that pipe that encapsulates your data that you're sending and receiving with encryption and makes it not penetrable like the open pipe would be.
When does Beth D'Angelo use a virtual private network or VPN?
Well, I'll use it actually in a bunch of different use cases. One of the most interesting ways I use it is when I'm searching for travel, when I want to buy a plane ticket online.
And why is that?
A lot of the services that you would buy, plane tickets or rent cars or hotel rooms through, they are tracking where you are searching from. So they're using various devices within your browser that allow them to know who is searching for this service they want to purchase or this plane ticket they want to purchase. They will track how many times you've looked for the same ticket. They'll know that you have a demand for it. Huh. And every time you look for it, you're going to get a different price. And the price is going to keep going up and up and up. But if you turn on a VPN while you're searching, they won't be able to see who it is and where they're coming from looking at that specific search stream. So they're not tracking you. They don't know it's you. They're not going to keep upping the price every time you look at it.
Well, I'll be darned. Okay, that seems like it's worth its weight in whatever software is required. But is this something I should pay?
Yeah, real hot tip.
Yeah, no kidding. That could save us some money. But is that something I should be paying money for, a virtual private network? Are there free ones that would work just as well? Where would I go to find the best VPN, Beth?
Yeah, there are free VPN services that you can download for your device. They're good for short-term use, once-in-a-while use. A lot of them have ads or a wait time or aren't quite as reliable as the paid versions. But what I usually recommend is if people are already purchasing a security suite for their device, like antivirus and anti-malware and firewall protection, through something like Norton 360 or McAfee or one of the other major services, generally those come with a VPN that's provided as part of that package. So you can go ahead and use the VPN service that comes with that you're already paying for.
And which devices would I want to use the VPN and these security software security packages on? All of them?
All of them. Yeah. And generally they're subscription-based. So you pay for a yearly subscription, and it will cover up to a certain number of devices.
Okay. and they may just save you enough money on travel alone to make them worth their while. So that is a great tip. Beth D'Angelo, our guest, senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, otherwise known as DOIT, on the UW-Madison campus. And we're inviting you to our tech update today with your tech questions, whether they are basic or advanced, at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Amy in Iola next. Amy, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, I run an Airbnb, and I need to set up a guest network, I guess, so that I keep my information private.
Oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We talked about connecting to an open or unsecure public network, but what about when you need to share your home personal network, like Amy does, with visitors, strangers, or even friends or family, Beth?
Yeah, that is a great idea. And I would highly recommend, if you have Wi-Fi in your home and you expect that there are people going to be using your Wi-Fi and you don't want them to have direct access to the same network all of your devices are on, the Wi-Fi router that you're using for your signal currently has an interface that you can get to through a web browser. And within that management interface, that tool that comes with it, you'll be able to create a guest network that you can password protect or leave open as an unsecure public network that isolates that traffic from the network that you use for your devices. So you can create a separate segregated space that doesn't intersect on that device that'll keep that traffic private.
So there is a web portal, a website that connects to your router that will allow you to change the settings on your router that would allow you to separate your home and personal network from a guest or visitor network.
Correct. So if you want to find that interface, the easiest way to do that is to just do a search for the model of router that you're using with the term admin portal or administrative portal. And it'll tell you how to get to that web page for your specific device and how to set up that guest network.
Those portals, as I have seen in the past, Beth, might also require a login and password. They might also not. Would you recommend a login and pass for that portal to your router?
Absolutely, 100%. That is a great question. So most of those routers come with a default username and password.
Like admin or something like that.
It's usually admin or admin or blank and admin or admin and default, but it's very easy to figure out because they're pretty much all the same depending on the manufacturer. And if somebody hasn't changed that password, somebody not even in your home, but somebody who can see your Wi-Fi signal outside your home could connect to your router. If you haven't changed that password, they put in what they know as the default. They have access to your router. They have access to your home network and every device that's on it. So I always change that. That's the first thing I do when I set up a new router, is change that admin password.
Well, and Beth D'Angelo, as we started the conversation, our Wi-Fi has gotten stronger. It has gotten more secure. There are more options, and it stretches further than the old wireless routers have in the past. At what point do you consider updating your router to the latest version or a more powerful version?
Yeah, I think if you're seeing your Wi-Fi signal dropping frequently or things seem to be slowing down, often that type of behavior can be fixed by just rebooting your router. A lot of people don't do that very often. And if there's some sort of, bottleneck going on within the device, rebooting it oftentimes will clear that up. Or if you're dropping your connection frequently, suddenly stops working and then starts working again 2 minutes later, usually a reboot will fix that. But if that's happening more often and a reboot's not fixing it, or you find that your Wi-Fi signal isn't reaching all parts of your home, or you're just not getting the signal strength that you need to be able to stream video, on the other side of your house, oftentimes that's a good opportunity to upgrade to something a little stronger, a little newer, or with better coverage.
Some people rent their routers from their internet service provider. Would it still be a possibility of making those changes in the portal to the administrative settings, even if you're renting your router from an ISP?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Same. You should be able to access it like when you purchased. And then even if you do, so I got my internet service comes with a router, and then I bought my own Wi-Fi router to connect to that internet access point, so that I had a little bit more control over my home network and a bit more powerful router. So basically I chained the two together, and I use one for my internet coming into my house. And then my device that I purchased on my own takes that connection and distributes it out to my house.
Beth D'Angelo back with us today, Senior IT Specialist with UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. If you have questions about your cell phone, computer, or even connecting your smart TV, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. Kyle, we'll get to you in 1 minute. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and this is WPR News. It's the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry, and stay with us because afternoon today we take a look at the historic record beneath our feet and what the fossils of Wisconsin tell us about our own ancient history. Don McCullough, curator at the Weiss Earth Science Museum, our guest. Right now, Beth D'Angelo sharing what we need to know about keeping ourselves safe online, how to use the Wi-Fi and employ the VPN, which is the Virtual Private Network. Kyle and Winnicani has a question about using a VPN. We'll go there next. Good morning, Kyle.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question. What you're talking about, it was kind of tracking, like, would the demographic area where your VPN make a difference? Where if I go to a VPN in Palo Alto versus like a VPN in Huntsville, Alabama, where Palo Alto is more expensive generally. So I was wondering if you get a different price based on something like that.
Interesting question. And I've seen this come up too on VPNs where you can connect with what would seem to be something that is across the country or even around the world, Beth.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That does happen based on where your actual location is in the world. Prices may change when you're searching for something online because that site that you're searching through knows where you are in the world and where you are searching from. So here's an anecdote. Searching for international travel to fly, let's say, from Chicago to Rome. If I search from here, from where I'm at, not using a VPN, for a flight from Chicago to Rome, I'm going to get one price. And if I connect to a VPN that says I'm in Italy and I look for the same ticket, it's going to be less. So it really does matter where the website thinks you're coming from. If you're looking at something that has a very variable pricing structure like travel, where the cost can change based on so many different variables and algorithms, you know, there are a lot of ways to kind of game the system.
So when you're shopping around, do you just shop around from different VPN locations?
It really depends on what I'm shopping for. So
okay.
Yeah, especially with travel. And then another interesting thing. So streaming services like Netflix, they have certain titles available depending on where you are in the world. So while something might be licensed for you to view while you're in the United States, if you're in a different country and you want to view that same thing, you won't be able to if you're connected to the internet in that other country. You can connect to your VPN and look like you're coming from the U.S. and that same content will then be available to you on Netflix.
Hey, Kyle, does that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you guys very much. A great answer. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for asking it, Kyle. I appreciate that. Beth, we talked a little bit about updating your router and when's the best time to do that in order to get more features and more signal strength. But what if you just wanted to extend the signal strength of your Wi-Fi in your home without purchasing a new router? What's the best way to go about that?
Yeah, I generally recommend that people look at something called mesh Wi-Fi, which is essentially creating like a wider net within your home that carries that signal. So what mesh Wi-Fi can do is take your existing internet signal and kind of boost that out to further distances and give a stronger signal in a larger area of your home.
Do they have extenders as well, and would those be as effective?
Yeah, there are. So you can get Wi-Fi extenders or signal boosters. I've found some to be a little bit more effective than others.
Yeah.
But really, mesh Wi-Fi is a more comprehensive way of distributing the signal than just a booster. So it tends to be a bit more reliable, and there's fewer gaps in coverage with that.
The one we use in our building complex is Eero by Amazon, E-E-R-O, mm-hmm. and we set up mm-hmm. three of them, and we're able to have, share internet among a number of us inside the house. So I found that, very useful, and the signal strength has been very strong. I want to double back to something you had mentioned earlier that comes up on a regular basis with our mm-hmm. IT department here at WPR, and it is the valuable power of the reboot and how often that can solve a problem when you're thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to be a technical snafu that I won't be able to solve. And then the IT guy comes in and said, well, did you try to unplug it and plug it back in? And how often that becomes a solution still boggles my mind, Beth.
And, really, honestly, to the point where it's a running joke amongst my colleagues and myself that it doesn't matter what the thing is that someone is mentioning has a problem, that one of us will inevitably say, have you tried turning it off and turning it back on again? Which, inevitably leads to groans and laughter and, eye rolling. But I wish I had a nickel for every time I've said that to someone when they ask me, what's wrong with this? I say, well, have you tried turning it off and turning it back on again? And I don't mean to say seem patronizing or condescending when I say it. Really, 95% of the time when you're dealing with any type of electronic device, shutting it down fully, waiting 10, 15 seconds, turning it back on, letting it fully power back on will likely resolve your problem.
Why? What is it that makes it stop and then start and work again?
We could be here all day talking about that. is the why really as important is that it just works.
as far as IT goes, that's about as much as you need to know. And I found that more often than not, and I still find it funny today. Every time they say, well, have you tried unplugging it and plugging it back in? Yeah, that seems to do the trick. Beth D'Angelo, our guest, senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Do It. That's the Division of Information Technology, answering your tech questions today from the basic to the advanced at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us, talk@WPR.org. Now, more often than not, when we're connecting to the internet, Beth, we're using a web browser, but not all web browsers are created equal. And I'm wondering how an IT specialist sees which browser to use and why.
Yeah, well, a couple of different factors will weigh in on which browser you choose. First being, what kind of device are you on? Are you on an Apple device? Are you on a Windows device? Are you on an Android device? Most of those come with a browser built into the operating system. So if we talk about something like a PC, your basic laptop with Windows loaded on it, that's going to come with Microsoft Edge, which is their built-in browser. It's decent. Personally, I don't use it. I prefer to use Chrome when I'm working on a Windows machine. Mm-hmm. The Apple platform or Macintosh comes with Safari as its built-in web browser, and that's the same on a mobile device like an iPhone or an iPad. It's going to come with Safari. So Google devices, so an Android device is going to come with Chrome built into it. And Chrome is my preferred browser as an easy use on any device. But if I'm looking for more security or more privacy or less tracking of my internet activity, then I look to a browser called DuckDuckGo, which is a little less known. It's not one of the big ones that's more well known, but has a lot more privacy and security built into it and is a favorite of IT folks like myself.
That's DuckDuckGo?
DuckDuckGo.
The one that I thought was more secure than the pre-installed options that come with an Android or an Apple or a Microsoft computer or phone was the Firefox from Mozilla.
Yeah, Firefox is also a great option. I used Firefox for years until I really started getting more involved with DuckDuckGo and using that more, because it is definitely a more secure browser than what is installed at, by default on an operating system.
And when you mean also, more secure, Beth, what do you mean by that?
Well, they're tracking less because Firefox isn't tied to a company like Google or Microsoft, mm-hmm. which is collecting your data in order to sell to other vendors to use for targeted advertising. So it's a little bit more independent, and you're going to see a higher level of privacy and more ability to manipulate your privacy settings within Firefox.
Okay, but you've made the jump from Firefox now to DuckDuckGo as a web browser because you found that more secure. Is it just more security options? Is it less tracking, less pop-ups? That's something that I'm always looking for.
What I like about DuckDuckGo is it's not tracking your activity in order to serve you personalized ads.
Okay.
So they're not relying on that for revenue to support their business. So they're not looking at the consumers of the product as the actual product, which a lot of the other browser providers kind of, the people who are using the browser are actually the product, not the browser itself.
Now, most of these browsers have the options of plugins where you can grab little software mm-hmm. that would add or subtract to your web browsing experience. What should we look for when it comes to these plugins to our browsers and some of the dangers they might provide and some of the benefits they might have?
Yeah, so those are becoming more and more prevalent now, especially with all of the new AI gizmos and doodads that are becoming companions to browser applications. I would be very cautious about add-ins and take a look at the data that they access and the data that they share before installing one to work with my browser. So take a look at the privacy settings that you can manipulate within that tool. I would look at any of their policy on data collection and data sharing. And I would look at the various types of tools that they use for collecting that data, whether or not they're using cookies or, link tracking or, various things that sometimes can behave like malware.
So read the fine print on this. The terms and conditions may be worth not just browsing through, but scouring to make sure that what you're adding isn't taking away from your privacy online, security online, and your experience online.
Exactly.
Thank you. Beth D'Angelo, our guest, and taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Jim in Wausau next. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling about the changes that happened a few months ago to Yahoo Mail, supposed improvements that seem to me to have made it much more difficult to use.
What was the experience?
Well, they added supposed artificial intelligence summary to the emails, but that has now disguised the actual email address of the sender. So you can't tell the obvious scams by the funny email addresses.
Sure.
I discovered that if you go to the option to block sender, they do show the actual address. But it doesn't really pay to block the sender because they keep changing those addresses regularly. But at least you can confirm that. But the other irritating change is it's now difficult to send emails to the archive. That's not an option under Move, and I'm wondering if anyone may know how you get around it. I'm pretty sure there'd be an escape for that.
I would like to think so, Jim, and sometimes these advancements aren't necessarily to the benefit of the user. And Beth, what do you know about changes to Yahoo Mail, integrating AI into mail, and protecting us against some of the fraudsters that enter our inbox?
Yeah, it seems like all of the mail providers now are starting to build AI into their interfaces to quote-unquote help you. and I think often we find some of these features a little bit more like they get in the way than they assist us with what we're trying to do. And oftentimes it's helpful to switch back to the classic interface of something rather than to use the new version until you're more familiar with, you know, how the new features work and how you can work them into your processes for using the tool. I know Yahoo does allow an option to switch back to the classic view if you don't like the new version of it and you don't want to see it that way, or you're having trouble finding some of the features that you used to use and you want to go back to being able to do that. If you go into your account settings within your Yahoo Mail, there is an option under the little gear icon that allows you to switch it back to the classic view so you can see that old version of it again. I'll warn you that likely at some point that classic version will go away. So if there are features that you're not able to find in the new version, I would do a quick search in Google about, you know, how do I find this setting in the new view of Yahoo Mail, and likely it'll give you instructions on where that is.
Well, let me ask you about this, Beth, because you mentioned Googling something to figure it out. And Jim, I'm sure that if you're having a problem with Yahoo Mail, there are others like you, and you will find solutions or at least workarounds online by searching for the same problems that you're having. But if you've moved to the DuckDuckGo web browser, how come you haven't moved to the DuckDuckGo web search, Beth?
I still do Google quite a bit, you know, especially if I'm like asking like a crowdsource question.
Okay.
You know, if I want like the largest group of people to weigh in on what I'm trying to figure out, and I want to take a diverse set of opinions and try to distill that into my own version of what I want to try next, reaching out to a wider audience through something like Google, it's going to give you a lot more data to pull from in order to come up with an answer. So as far as like getting more data points, something like Google is definitely a powerful tool because of all of the history behind it and all of the data collection that they have done. But for like how-tos, or if I'm trying to ask a question or crowdsource information, I've actually found Reddit to be an awesome tool for that.
Oh, nice.
You gotta be careful about where you ask. So often somebody's already asked the question that you're asking, and you can find hundreds of answers that'll lead you to the right choice.
Reddit.com has forums for just about everyone and everything. But yeah, buyer beware when you go in there, and make sure that the answers you're getting seem to be at least substantiated by others inside that forum who have had similar experiences. And the other thing about searching on Google, using Google as a search, that I've found is I tend to want to scroll past the sponsored responses or answers before I get to something that I'd feel confident about.
Yeah, that's another good point. Google is also, you know, if you have, like I use Google in my Chrome web browser sometimes, and the combination of those two generates an AI overview of your search results. Be careful when looking at those AI overviews. The accuracy is questionable. the AI has a tendency to... Sometimes we call it hallucinating.
Yeah, but why do they call it hallucinating when it's just getting it wrong?
Well, because it thinks it's right.
it doesn't matter if it thinks it's right. It is inaccurate information. It is wrong. It is false. And calling it a hallucination is, I don't think, accurate, or at least as precise as it could be when you're just talking about AI as it continues to artificial intelligence as it continues to develop what it knows, revealing itself to not know so much in some places still.
Maybe they call it hallucinating because sometimes the return results are real weird.
Yeah, well, that does make sense. But speaking about Google and Chrome and ads, let's go to Esty in Madison next. Esty, good morning.
Good morning. I just want to add to what you guys were just discussing before I ask my question. I have used DuckDuckGo. I nowadays use Brave, which is another one like it. And both of them are just, in my opinion, terrible. When you need to search for someone, I always end up going to Google for that.
Okay.
But, you know, that's not a very big price to pay, right? to keep your privacy. So, but my question is, the last time that I upgraded to Chrome, what started happening is pretty much every third time that I ask Google for something, instead of answering, it sends me to a page that is an ad. It's not it's not just the advertising page that we're used to, but it's an ad. And that seemed very strange and suspicious.
Esty, can I ask you, do you have antivirus software or some security software on your computer? Have you run a scan for antivirus on there?
That's a very good question. No, I have not done that. But I did uninstall it and then reinstalled, and it's still doing the same. So I wonder if you'll guess, what do you think might be going on there?
Great question, Esty, and thank you for calling. And Beth, what do you think is going on there?
Yeah, so I think that... most of the results that you're seeing on the first page of your search are going to be sponsored results at this point because of, Google's revenue streams. They're promoting more and more sponsored content than they had previously. And I think with the newer versions of Chrome, often the results that you're seeing are not, it's actually changing the search string in order to allow the browser to return more sponsored results to you rather than the most correlated or most relevant results.
Well, that doesn't sound like something I would... That doesn't sound like it benefits the user as much as it benefits those who are paying to be seen by Google.
Correct.
Yeah.
Definitely a benefit to Google's revenue stream.
So, I that would be a tough one when deciding what to search for if all you're getting on your Chrome web browser. Maybe you try the DuckDuckGo web browser and then use the Google search?
Yeah. Actually, we'll just skip to the second page of Google search results if I start with that.
Oh, interesting. All right. So there's a combination to try, Esty, and thank you for your question. Let's go to Tree in Montello next. Tree, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
What's your question?
I just want to know how to stop pop-ups on my phone. I'll be trying to Google something or trying to, call someone, and all of a sudden something will pop up and I have to exit out or, try to get rid of it before I can continue. And then another one will show up.
What kind of phone do you have, Tree?
I have a Samsung iPhone or Android?
Oh, it's Android. Okay. So because it might be different experiences depending on the actual cell phone and the software inside it. And you can't see me right now, Tree, but I am shaking my fist in the air at those pop-up ads that come up on my cell phone. And I have to have a very precise little finger to make sure that the pop-up ad goes away and I don't accidentally click into another ad that takes me somewhere away from what I was trying to look for in the first place. Are there ways to get rid of these pop-up ads on Android or iPhones, Beth?
Yeah, absolutely. So specific to Android, there's a couple different ways you can do this. If it's a specific application that's throwing pop-ups, you can disable the notifications for that application by going into the settings and then apps section. And there should be a notifications option within those settings. So that's specific to an application.
Okay.
But if it's an app overlay that's popping up, you can go into those settings again, and then there's a section called special access. And if you go into that special access section, you can turn off the appear on top function that will disable any of those overlays from popping up over the top of the application you have open. And then you can also adjust the settings in the browser that you're using. So if it's Chrome or Firefox, you can go into the settings. And if you go into site settings, you can turn off the pop-ups and redirects toggle.
And would it be worth experimenting with different web browsers on a cell phone to see what provides the best experience and minimizes those pop-up ads, Beth?
Yeah, I think that can definitely be a way to minimize those. If you experiment with various different browser applications and one of them seems to do less of that than others. But within these settings, you should be able to turn it off for any browser that you're using. So hopefully then one wouldn't be better than the other. It just won't happen with any of them.
Tree, thank you for the call, because you had the same question I had for our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. otherwise known as Do It. Your questions, we've still got time, 1-800-642-1234. What tech questions do you have for our guest? That's next. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show. Larry's back tomorrow with a look at the first ever blood test to show Alzheimer's disease. Then we'll find out how to best talk to someone who has dementia. And in the last hour, how to take care of your mouth, the best techniques in oral hygiene. All coming up tomorrow with Larry on The Larry Mueller Show. Right now, it's our Tech Update Monday with Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist with UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And Beth, earlier we were talking about the importance of seeing that padlock when making a Wi-Fi connection. But I also see padlocks when it comes to browsing websites in the web browser. What does that padlock mean, and how should I view those web addresses and what I see in what my web address bar in terms of staying safe?
Yeah, that little lock icon, it refers to something called SSL, or Secure Socket Layer, which nobody needs to know about.
Okay.
But what it essentially means is that the website that you are connecting to, or the website that you are browsing to, has additional security built into it, into the code of the website, that encrypts the data that you transmit through that site. So it's telling you that this is a secure website and not an open website without encryption.
So that's a website where I could put my personal information, my credit card number, health data. And when I do not see that padlock, should I abstain from putting in my personal information, my credit card number, and my health data?
100%. Any legitimate business or organization that is collecting that information will have taken the steps to secure their web presence in order to collect that data from you. There are actually federal regulations that require it. For collecting certain types of data for certain businesses.
Beth, what about when I look in the address bar of my web browser and I see addresses that start with HTTP or HTTPS? Is there a difference between the two?
That is the same thing.
Okay.
The HTTP is an unsecure, non-encrypted text website. Doesn't have those additional layers of encryption or security around it. HTTPS is the secure version of that code that includes that type of encryption.
That is good to know. Let's go back to your questions now with our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Curtin, Columbia County. You're next. Good morning.
Good morning. Good information. I'd like Beth to compare two upgrades I'm considering. The first, I still have a landline from the local phone company with a bandwidth of 2. They say they can upgrade it to about 10 by having people come into the house and rewire, versus what you folks have been talking the last hour about wireless at, say, DuckDuckGo or Spectrum to get a higher bandwidth so I can stream. What do you think?
Those are, I am glad you called, Kurt and Beth. So you can update the upgrade the landline, or those aren't necessarily two different things, are they?
Yeah, I'll give a little bit of explanation. So it sounds like you've got currently a broadband internet connection that runs about 2 megabits per second for your speed, and you have the opportunity to either have that rewired to your home to get 10 megabits per second download speed, or to switch to a different provider to get a higher download speed. And if that's what we're thinking about, just really one thing to keep in mind, if you're looking at streaming video, a good rule of thumb is that you want at least 6 megabits per second to be able to stream video without buffering at a high resolution. So at 2 megabits per second right now, you're going to have a lot of problems. If you can upgrade to 10 with your current, you know, setup, and they just need to rewire it to your home, I don't believe there should be any cost to you to upgrade the lines coming to your home. But if it's something within your home that needs to be changed, You may want to look at having that 10 megabit connection brought into your house and then getting a router that will support that higher speed of Wi-Fi to your devices.
So it might be a cost issue and probably something to look into in terms of the bottom line, but when it comes to streaming, which is what many of us use internet for, 6 megabytes per second is about the bare minimum?
Yeah, that's really what you want for a stable connection without having the, you know, the video buffering all the time or, you know, having it be choppy or stopping and starting or coming in at a lower resolution than it's supposed to.
Hey, I got an email from Steve here who would like you to suggest a router brand for him. Is there one that comes to mind, Beth?
I have a Netgear router.
Okay.
I believe Netgear was purchased by Cisco, so it's now Cisco branded. The one that I use is called a Nighthawk. It's excellent. It reaches my whole house, yard, property very well.
Nighthawk.
Nighthawk. I bought it a couple of years ago. I think it was maybe, it was under $300 at the time.
Oh, nice.
It probably come down in price since then. If you're just covering a normal size home, you shouldn't need to purchase anything extraordinary.
Otto emailed. He says he uses the Opera web browser and downloading it and automatically blocks all pop-ups. And he also has a VPN, virtual private network, and he doesn't have to do anything else. That's good information, Otto. I appreciate that. Let's go next to Steve in Ironwood, Michigan, who has a question for our guest, Beth D'Angelo. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. I've got a desktop. I've had the same email address for 20 years, and I used to get 3-4 spams a week. Now I'm getting 100 and since the first of the year. A lot of them have politicians' name on them. I won't mention politicians' name, but...
Well, I appreciate that, Steve, but this inundation of spam, I am sure you are not alone in that regard. And what can he do with his inbox or, for that matter, maybe his internet service provider? He's with Charter, Beth. Is there a way to go to get back what he lost in terms of a clean inbox?
Yeah, I know. Spam is like the bane of our existence. In my world of IT, we fight spam every day. But it's not going away. So we have to find better ways to kind of filter it out. There are a couple of different things you can do. So if it's stuff that's already coming into you and it's not something that you can like set up ahead of time to prevent it from starting in the first place, there usually are, depending on who your email provider is, ways to report that address to your provider as a spammer. So usually there's a tool either built into the web interface that you use for checking your email where you can, select a message and check a box that says this is spam.
Mm-hmm.
And that will actually train the spam filters that your provider is using to filter that out in the future. So you can help prevent future spam from coming by being diligent about anytime you see one, just report it and block it. And eventually those spam filters learn that this is not a valid sender and they'll block it for you and it'll never come to your email. The other thing you can do, this is something that I've done for years. Once spam started to become a really prevalent problem, I created a second email account that I only use for signing up for things.
Oh.
If I need to create an account that requires an email address, if I need to, if I'm going to get a rewards card at the grocery store and they need my email address for it, I'm going to give them this email address. And it's not the one I use for my personal correspondence. It's not my work address. It's not my personal address. It's basically a dummy address that I use. Then if they're going to start selling that information to other people to spam me or they're going to be spamming me, they're going to spam that account that I don't care about. I'm not going to look at it. It's not going to gum up my inbox that I use every day.
Do you ever use the unsubscribe link that is often found at the bottom of these spam emails? And is it effective? I've only got about 30 seconds, Beth.
Yeah, they can be effective, but I've also found a service called Unsubscribe Me.
Oh.
Unsubscribe.me is a great service for scouring where you are subscribed and unsubscribing you.
Beth D'Angelo, you are a great service. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Lee.
Beth D'Angelo is a senior IT specialist with UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Stay with us because next we'll look at the ancient history that lies beneath our feet and the story it tells. And then also this next hour, we'll take a look at the evolution of human evolution. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News. So it may be hard to believe, but it was hundreds of millions of years ago that our place we call Wisconsin was under the sea, a shallow sea. And as well, we were south of the equator. We know this by looking at the fossils we found beneath our feet and the untold, the history that is unfurled around us. It helped us understand where we came from and perhaps will help us understand better where we're going. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. This is the Larry Mueller Show, and joining us next is Don Mikulik. He's been the curator of the Weiss Earth Science Museum in Menasha since 2002. He's on the board of the Niagara Escarpment Resource Network, and he retired as a senior paleontologist at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. He's co-authored the book Fossils from the Milwaukee Formation. And what questions do you have about Wisconsin's fossils and our history? Have you visited the museum in Menasha? What do you love about it? We'd like to hear from you next at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@WPR.org. And Don, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's start with a little bit of the fossils beneath our feet. And what are some of the fossils that we have found in Wisconsin that have fascinated you?
Well, they're mostly marine fossils from long before the age of dinosaurs. Things like trilobites, crinoids, corals, cephalopods, things like that. Nothing much living on land at the time, so it's mostly marine fossils.
And this is because we were underwater so many hundreds of millions.
We were underwater for a long time, several hundred million years.
And do we know how we went from being underwater to being Wisconsin?
It's a long process, but it goes temporarily with ice ages, so water goes up and down just a few hundred feet. That made a big difference back in the Paleozoic days, several hundred million years ago. But the continent as a whole has risen a bit, so we don't get flooded anywhere like we used to.
And I think most of us understand the glaciers that rolled through the eastern part of Wisconsin and missed the driftless area of Wisconsin, and that's the land formation we have today, and it's a little bit of the geoheritage that we have. And what do we mean when we say geoheritage, Don?
Well, geoheritage refers to how geology impacts our lives, the way the area settled, how it develops, things like that. So if you think about anything about where cities are located, transportation routes, mm-hmm. water bodies, all those sorts of things are all related to geology, and all those things impact how people settle and develop the land.
You think about the farmland, you think about the passages through the Great Lakes, and you think about the driftless region and the beautiful area there along the all the way out to the mighty Mississippi.
Right, and we also have a big feature in Wisconsin that people don't know about is certainly as well as the driftless area, and it's the Niagara Escarpment. It's a 1,000-mile-long feature that extends from about Waukesha County, as where it first appears in Wisconsin, goes north through Door County, all the beautiful cliffs, Door County, through UP, into the Weirton Peninsula of Ontario, down to Niagara Falls, and into Rochester, New York. So that's one rock formation that covers a vast area.
A single rock formation that goes on for hundreds, thousands of miles?
About 1,000 miles.
And tell me, how does that fit into the geoheritage of Wisconsin and the state today?
Well, it's defined a lot of the eastern border of Wisconsin. Primarily, it defines Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, and Lake Ontario.
Huh.
So water bodies, when certainly indigenous peoples knew about this, but when the Europeans, the French in particular, first came to the area, they were settling up in Canada. And when they wanted to explore farther into the continent, they would follow these waterways, and they're basically waterways determined by the Niagara Escarpment. Like I said, these big Great Lakes are, in general, their configuration is related to the distribution of rocks of the escarpment.
So when I look at the Great Lakes, I'm actually looking at something that was helped created by this Niagara Escarpment and has been here for since before the Great Lakes, Don?
Absolutely. Huh. I don't know when it really started, certainly before the Ice Age. People always sort of talk about how the glacial ice impacted the escarpment, but actually the escarpment impacted the ice. It's a hard rock body when ice started to flow to the south. In Wisconsin, it ran into the Door County Peninsula and divided into two ice sheets. That's how strong the escarpment is. So with that, you had two glacial lobes that flowed south and essentially buried the escarpment in the southern part of the state where the Kettle Moraine is.
So this is all part of the Weiss Earth Science Museum in Menasha, which is part of the UW Oshkosh and the Fox Cities. Tell me a little bit more about the Weiss Earth Science Museum, Don.
Its mission is to discuss, educate people about the Wisconsin's geologic and mining history, and it shows how geology affected the development of various areas, certainly around the Fox Cities area in northeastern Wisconsin. That's all based on a geologic feature. We have, for example, we have the Green Bay Packers because of the Niagara Escarpment. So they're there because of geology.
Wait, we got the Packers football team
because
of the Niagara Escarpment.
Exactly.
Explain this.
Well, there would be no Green Bay. So the water flows east in that area from sort of the high part in the central Wisconsin and flows east until it runs into the escarpment and has a right raw flow off the side into Green Bay.
Okay.
So if there wasn't an escarpment there blocking that water
flow, no Green Bay, no Packers.
That's right.
Now, the Weiss Earth Science Museum lists as the official mineralogical museum of Wisconsin. How many other museums are there like this?
There's no other museum like this in Wisconsin. There's no other museum like this in the Midwest. And I can't say for the entire country, but a museum that focuses primarily on the geologic and mining history of a specific area like a state is a very unique feature.
Does it have fossils?
We have fossils. We have rocks and minerals. We have all kinds of things, lots of programs, educational programs, stuff.
What's one of your favorite fossils you'd find at the Weiss Earth Science Museum, Don?
Trilobites, of course. That's the official state fossil of Wisconsin. That's the kind of fossils I do research on.
And would I still be able to find fossils of trilobites in Wisconsin?
Sure. They're all over the place.
Where would I look? What's the best
place? Right in Madison here. There's places you can find trilobites. Yeah.
So you just got to, you know, we had a guest talking about space last week on the Larry Mueller Show, talking with Larry, and he said, you know, you just need to look up. You just need to look up. And with you, Don, it feels like, you just need to look down.
Yep.
And are there hot spots for fossils? Are there still places that we're discovering our ancient past in fossil form?
Well, there's few fossils in the north and north central part of Wisconsin, but all along the western part, southern part, and the eastern part, there's places where if you can see the rock exposures, you can find fossils.
And what do they tell you and how do they speak to you about our history?
Well, fossils in general are real important because it was the use of fossils to determine the great age of the Earth is one of the seminal ideas in science. So in the 1700s, people would think that anytime you'd see like a limestone deposit, it would be the same age as limestone deposits all around the world. Well, people started to realize that there's different kinds of fossils in these deposits and start to get an idea at least that there's geologic time represented here that people didn't realize existed.
That can take us back hundreds of millions of years, that can find us beneath the sea, that can find us south of the equator where we're standing right now.
Yep.
So considering that our history hundreds of millions of years ago and the fossils we found that have helped us realize that, what does that mean for hundreds of millions of years from today and the future of where Wisconsin will sit on this planet, Don?
Eventually, we're going to collide into one big mega continent again.
Really? I think the theory was we started as one big landmass on this planet, more or less, and it started to separate and divide.
It goes back and forth because you have these plates shifting around and they got to go somewhere, and either they all split up for a while or they all run into each other for a while, so that kind of alternates.
The tectonic plates that we talk about, is how recent of a discovery is that? Is that something we've always known or something we've realized?
That's a very new thing. So when I was a young person, that was a real radical new idea. People had proposed that for decades before, but nobody could understand how it worked. Therefore, if you can't understand how it worked, then how could it happen?
But this escarpment land feature, this is the Niagara escarpment land feature. This is not part of tectonic plates, is it?
No. Maybe it has some origins in the fact that that's how it developed, but that's
originally.
But that's not well understood.
So we could find ourselves hundreds of millions of years today as part of one grand landmass once again?
We could.
I've got a question about fossils that I've always wondered. Well, not always wondered, but Jurassic Park movies wondered. Don, did dinosaurs have feathers?
Certainly a lot of the little ones had feathers. Not so sure about larger ones, at least as adult large animals. So it's possible that small Tyrannosaurus rexes had feathers, but the whole reason to have feathers is to keep warm. So when you're a really big animal, you don't cool off very well overnight. So
you don't need those feathers.
You
might shed those feathers.
Right.
So when we look around today and we see feathered birds all around us and hear their cries, are we looking at something from our Jurassic period?
We're looking at dinosaurs.
We are looking at little dinosaurs.
Little dinosaurs.
That is fascinating. So when I see the wild turkeys running across the streets, I can take that back.
They're dinosaurs.
Don McCulloch is our guest, paleontologist and curator of the Weiss Earth Science Museum in Menasha, taking your questions about Wisconsin's geoheritage at 1-800-642-1234 or email us talk@wpr.org. Bob and Clay Banks, we'll go to you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having the show. Don, I just wondered what your comments might be about the meteor impact site in southern Door County.
We have evidence discovered by people from our museum of an impact site in southern Door County. We don't know the age. It's something less than 400 million years old, and it's probably older, though, than recent glaciation and make it older than a couple million years ago. It's not well exposed, so it's difficult to study. We do have evidence, though, of things like shatter cones, which are only formed either by comet impacts or meteor impacts or nuclear explosions. I think this is going to be one of the first two that cause that thing. It looks like it's a very eroded structure, so what you're looking at is not so much a crater, but you're looking at the infill of the crater. The crater itself has been eroded away, so that suggests it's a pretty old feature.
How big is that?
It's about a mile in diameter.
Oh, wow! That would have been a big impact, wouldn't
it'd
it?
It'd be a big one, yeah.
So can you see that today with the naked eye or through the air in a drone?
You can see it on Google Earth Maps. You can see a nice donut of trees around this hill that is Brussels Hill.
Is there still research to be done on this crater impact, Don?
Yeah, I'm working with somebody from the University of Vienna who's an impact specialist on that structure.
Very interesting. And when we mention the Weiss Earth Science Museum and the work you're doing there as a curator, it's not just, I mean, it's a museum that's won a few national awards. How has it been recognized?
It was given an award by American Geological Institute, which is sort of a conglomeration of all the professional geology organizations in the country. They get their education award. They gave it, but they don't give it every year. So it's a fairly rare award, and other people or places that got it. It was Robert Ballard for his oceanographic work and Titanic work, the British Broadcasting System for the Making of a Continent series and the Planet Earth series. Writers like Stephen Jay Gould, Simon Winchester, John McPhee, these are all people that got that, and our little museum got that.
The little museum that is the official Mineralogical Museum of Wisconsin. When could we visit this in Menasha, Don?
You can't anymore. It's closed.
How can we visit the museum in Menasha, Don? What would it take to reopen the doors, and how long have they been closed? What's going on?
The whole campus is being closed, and it closed for the month of June. Some parts of it are reopening. We're not necessarily scheduled to reopen. There's still a possibility that we might stay closed or we might open up. We don't have a final verdict on that. Lots of talk about this is a done deal, but it hasn't been signed off on
yet. A done deal to reopen or a done deal?
To close it.
but it's the official Mineralogical Museum of Wisconsin, the only one we know of in the Midwest and perhaps the country. It's award-winning, and who is going to ultimately make that decision?
I think it's in the hands of the Board of Regents now.
When do you expect that decision to come?
They had a meeting last week, but I haven't heard they decided anything. They might have and just not announced it, or that might be some weeks in the future.
What would you say we lose as the curator of this museum if the Weiss Earth Science Museum were not to open again?
Well, you lose a tremendous educational institution. We get about 15,000 people a year that come to our museum, about 10,000 are school children. We're not a museum of just objects. We have objects. We have dinosaur fossils and fancy minerals and things like that. But we're focused on education and education related to the geology and mining history of Wisconsin.
Would we lose research as well?
You certainly will.
That's the Weiss Earth Science Museum, and our guest, Don Mikulik, is the curator, also a paleontologist, taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Jeff in Berry Mills next. Jeff, good afternoon.
Yes, I've always had a question. Quite a few years back, around the early 90s, I excavated a hillside in the lower Coon Creek watershed, and it was all red clay, and you got down about 4 or 5 feet, and then it was kind of gray, streaky clay, really snotty stuff. And way down that far, I found a cinder about the size of a baseball, and I classified it as a cinder. And I'm just wondering, where could that cinder have originated amongst all this other clay? And there was no rocks in this stuff at all. It's just silty clay.
These sound like possibly glacial lake deposits and things of that nature.
Okay.
You might be looking at a burned piece of wood that has simply fallen in the water, got buried in the clay. That's a possibility. You can usually commonly find wood itself, parts of trees and stuff in some of these clay deposits. But I couldn't tell you much more than that without seeing more of it.
It's an interesting anomaly when you're starting to dig and excavate and you find something that you don't expect. You come across those anomalies, Don, in your work?
All the time.
Is it the mysteries that...
The mystery, yeah.
Yeah.
You're always sort of looking for things, but you're always finding things you didn't know were was going to be there.
But those things, those anomalies help us better understand these stories, right? If we can work our way back to how they got there and what they were originally...
Absolutely.
It means something about where we are right now.
Right. So when I started looking for looking at fossils in particular, when I was a young person, I was interested in just studying trilobites and stuff. Mm-hmm. But to understand the trilobites, you have to understand the environment they lived in, the way they were preserved, things of that nature, how they changed through time. And that all takes a lot of work. And pretty soon you started working on much bigger subjects than just the trilobites themselves.
So the trilobites of Wisconsin, they themselves evolved.
Absolutely. Well, in a global sense, they're evolving. But certainly the sandstone areas in Wisconsin, which is a Cambrian period of geologic time, the late Cambrian of the world was originally defined by different kinds of trilobite assemblages through time. Now, that's changed a bit, and they have places where you can see more detail, so it's not divided that way. But in the 1800s, early 1900s, Wisconsin was a hotspot for studying the biostratigraphy, as they call it, of these trilobites.
What was the legacy of Joanne Klusendorf and her role at the Weiss Earth Science Museum, Don?
Well, she's the Weiss Museum was funded to a large extent by Len and Donna Weiss. Joanne was the founding director. She designed the museum and the exhibits and did it in record time, and she's the one that got this award that we talked about from mm-hmm. American Geological Institute. And she developed programs in particular, educational programs, and it worked with all different kinds of people. She was a guest, I'm sure, several times on the show here and other shows around the state. She did an outstanding job of promoting geology, educating people, things like that, while doing research and everything else you can imagine. And the information that she tried to provide is not just for education, but for public, government, industry, things like that. So there was interconnections with people from all those kinds of organizations. So she's won other awards. She's real prominent in women's science education, things of that nature. So the museum is pretty much her as we look at it. She's the one that designed it. She's the one that got it right. And she's the one that knew how to promote these things in a way that a lot of museums don't. A lot of museums have nice objects.
Right.
They have a general story, but she got very specific about how this relates to Wisconsin and the community that you live in.
Beyond education to industry to our politics to everyday life, everything that's happening here in our geo-heritage and how it fits into that. But you would be a part of that legacy too, wouldn't you, Don, as the curator?
I'm sure I am some small part of that, hopefully. There's other aspects of things like geoheritage, too, and that is if you look at different communities, they develop because of different geologic characteristics, things that document transportation, but mineral resources are another thing.
Sure.
Wisconsin was formed as a mining state. We're the Badger State because of miners. At one time, back in the 1830s, Europeans first started to migrate to Wisconsin. There were Cornish miners who were out of work in Cornwall, and they came to mine lead in southwestern Wisconsin. People came and looked at the holes that they were digging and said, it looked like there's some badgers are digging here, so we became Badgers. In the meantime, or same time, Illinoisans would come sometimes just to dig in the summer and stuff like that. They weren't there all year long. And somebody noticed that they looked like suckerfish, behave like suckerfish, migrating up and down the streams. So Illinoisans were initially called suckers when we were called Badgers.
Is that true? Are you just making that up?
No, I've seen a newspaper article in the 1850 Chicago Tribune talking about that.
The suckers of Illinois.
Well, I don't know. I can't remember quite said it that way. But
Badgers of Wisconsin, I've heard that story before, but the suckers of Illinois is new to me.
Yeah, at the time I spent down there, that wasn't a frequently used term. And you got to think about it this way, Lincoln had to die to change it from the land of suckers to the land of Lincoln. So,
wow, and that's in some weird way our geo-heritage today
part of
in
our
Wisconsin.
And Illinois' geo-heritage.
Don McCulloch, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much. And we're going to keep an eye on the future of the Weiss Earth Science Museum and wish you and the museum all the best. I appreciate your wisdom today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When we continue, we'll look at what's changing when it comes to our own understanding of human evolution. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and this is WPR News. It's the Larry Mueller Show on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, who's back tomorrow. And here's a weird thing. Researchers are now finding that we are the product of an ancient genetic fusion between divergent human populations. What does that mean? There used to be this missing link or ghost ancestry in what we understood about human evolution, but that is beginning to change with the help of our guest, Aaron Ragsdale. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison. And we're taking a look at the university's role in our evolution of the understanding of human evolution. If you've got questions, so do I, but you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@wpr.org. And Aaron, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
It's wonderful to be here.
I want to start with what we have come to understand prior to your research about human evolution and what human evolution, how we used to understand how we got to where we are today in terms of our ancient ancestry and our genetics.
Yeah, so I think this is a question that goes back many decades, many centuries, really. People have always been interested in our origins and our evolutionary history.
Where did we come from? In Africa is where we all emanated from, right?
Yeah, and actually the understanding of the recent African origins of our species is actually quite recent. Even until the 80s and 90s, this was I think that was debated. There were kind of competing hypotheses about who were the ancestors of people who live around the world today? Where did we come from? How are we connected? Genetic data really was kind of the thing that really nailed it down, that we're all kind of closely related, relatively closely related, and come from a recent common ancestor that lived
in
Africa.
So it's development of genetic science and our understanding of our own genome in our body that has helped us understand our own ancestry and the fact that we probably all have come from the same continent and have an interconnectedness that theories prior to the 80s and 90s would not have found.
Yeah, exactly. And well, if we think about prior to the genetic data that was available, we have to remember this is a pretty recent field. The human genome was only first sequenced in 2003, the full genome. And prior to that, a lot of the hypotheses and arguments that were being, you know, taking place around this were really, really based on fossil data.
Interesting.
And a lot of the fossil data over the last million years was pretty sparse. There are a lot of sites and fossils from different places around the world, but it was really difficult to know how to really connect them all.
Yeah. And how did they fit together?
Yeah, and you could tell a lot of stories that tried to connect them, and it was hard to kind of distinguish between, you know, whether this hypothesis was supported or that hypothesis. So genetics really came in and helped solidify
that. How did those
bones
relate to these bones over here? And were these bones connected at some point in our lineage and ancient history?
Yeah, exactly.
But the genome sort of blew all the bones out of the water and decided, hey, here's a much more scientific approach to our own ancestry.
Well, I wouldn't say that exactly. I think there's a lot of value to the fossil record. What you really get from a fuller understanding is really gained by combining different what we call lines of evidence. So you have the line of evidence from the fossil data, and you have different lines of evidence from genetic data, and you try to synthesize these to tell a story that fits the observations that you see in the genetics and in the fossil and archaeological sites.
And this is the scientific method, where you are substantiating a hypothesis until it is disproven, and then you find another hypothesis that works better, and you use all the evidence that is available to try to make that work or to try to disprove it. And so right now we have a hypothesis about our where we all come from that has yet to be disproven, that we haven't been able to find a fault in.
Yeah, well, I think one of the hypothesis, the leading hypothesis, or the big picture of the recent African origins is, I think, on pretty solid ground.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like it's probably most likely not going to be disproved.
I don't think so. No.
But I think what most people think about when it comes to genetics is ancestry, 23andMe, taking a swab in your mouth and sending it off and finding out. How does something like that fit into some of the research that you've doing? How can I better understand the work that you've put into ancient ancestry and my understanding of it?
Yeah, so the science behind 23andMe or ancestry DNA, it's not all that different from what we do as geneticists. You know, we're taking sequencing data from individuals who have volunteered or been recruited to be in studies. Try to learn about shared ancestry among the individuals that you've sequenced. And so if you've sent in your saliva off to 23andMe and you get back some genetic information about, you know, you'll see who you're related to. If your siblings or your closely related cousins have also taken the test, you can find them through the shared bits of DNA that you've co-inherited from the same shared genetic ancestor. Now, if you zoom out a little bit, you can do the same sort of thing by connecting more distantly related individuals, or even what we would consider unrelated individuals. Because if you go back far enough in time, you will find a common ancestor. We're all related by a common ancestor. So it's just trying to piece together what were the bits of DNA, those little tiny bits of DNA that are connecting different individuals. How far back in time do you have to go to find those common ancestors?
But we're all connected at some point.
But we're all connected, yeah.
And that is the human evolution, is that at some degree we all have this connection. Tell me a little bit, Aaron Ragsdale, about your research and what you have set out to find and what some of your discoveries were.
Yeah, so the setup for this question was, okay, we know that humans evolved within Africa. We're an African species. And it was only relatively recently in our history that we expanded outside of Africa, within the last 50 to 100,000 years. So what was happening in those preceding, you know, from around a million years to 100,000 years ago, which this is, you know, something that's often been called the muddle in the middle. It's
the
kind of
muddle in the middle.
I love that term because it just captures it perfectly. This is the middle Pleistocene, this period, and the muddle refers to this complete unknown of which fossils are actually representative of our ancestors.
Huh.
Where did the populations live that actually gave rise to us all today? Was it a single population? Were they multiple populations that contributed to present-day people? How were they connected? Did they migrate across the continent? And so these were the basic questions that we were setting out to answer. Can we test competing hypotheses about who and where? Who were our ancestors? Where did they live? How were they connected? And using the genetic data of people living today from populations living across the African continent and around the world.
Prior to your research, was there some idea that we had not found a part of our human ancestry that we figured was part of evolution, that there was this ghost species somewhere inside that we needed to discover in order to put it all together?
There's also an interesting backstory to this, and this is that prior to around 2010, we didn't know that Neanderthals had actually contributed to our DNA. And I think it's pretty well accepted now that Neanderthals have contributed a small portion, on the order of 1 or a few percent at most.
They're connected to us too.
But what we thought for a long time that they were
separate species.
They were a separate species.
Yep. We had nothing to do
with
them.
We evolved in isolation and we completely replaced them without, absorbing any of their DNA. But when the Neanderthal genome was first sequenced, this was around 2008, 2009, 2010, it became really apparent that we actually do share, you wouldn't find it in a 23andMe analysis, but you'd be able to find little bits of DNA carried by especially non-African individuals, so Eurasian individuals, who have inherited some portion of their small bits of fragments of DNA from the Neanderthal lineage as well. And so this question about ghost adamant, this kind of helped to explain some of the conundrums that you see in
the muddle in the middle.
Yeah, some of it. And then it kind of became a little bit in vogue to evoke these long diverged ancestral lineages that were isolated for a long time and then recontacted with humans and to explain some of the patterns of the genetic variation that we see. And so when you look at genomes of African individuals, you see kind of similar, parallel, not exactly the same signatures, but similar types of signatures where it looks like maybe there was a long diverged lineage that also contributed to populations living in Africa today.
Sure.
And so there was kind of this parallel. You take this analogy of the Neanderthal introgression. Introgression just means kind of mixture from a long diverged lineage.
Being connected to us.
Yeah. And you kind of map that story onto these other groups that also have similar signatures in their DNA and try to tell a story kind of through analogy, I would say. But unlike the story with Neanderthals where we have their genome and we can actually confirm, we can look at the actual segments of DNA and match them up. We can say this piece on this segment of this chromosome, we can tell that it was inherited from Neanderthals because you share mutations with Neanderthals at those sites.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we don't have the equivalent DNA from a supposed long diverged population within Africa that might kind of by analogy also contribute to the human gene pool.
So this would be the mystery.
This is the mystery. So that's why it's called a ghost population because it's not a living population and it's not a population that we have a fossil of or that we could sequence the DNA of. And so it's a hypothesized, it's kind of a construct to try to explain the patterns and
to fill in the unknown right now. There's a blank there.
Mm-hmm.
But then Aaron Ragsdale, your research goes in and says maybe this ghost population never existed at all.
Yeah, and we looked at this problem and we thought, Africa is a large continent, but we also know that people probably moved around a lot like people move around today.
Sure.
People move around and interact with each other. It's going to be difficult to have populations that are living kind of as neighbors, but be isolated for many hundreds
we're
of thousands of years.
We're a social species.
Yeah, we're
we
social.
We like to get out.
We move around and we interact. Right, exactly.
That story makes sense to me. Yeah. I understand that story as just a part of the human condition, that we are interconnected and we seek that connection. And so the idea that we would be neighbors but not actually hang out together, well, that might be part of the internet age, but that's probably not part of our ancient history.
Yeah, probably not.
So what did your research begin to uncover when it came to closing the gaps and solving this mystery?
Yeah, so we tested these competing hypotheses about whether you needed a model that had isolation between groups and then recontact, kind of the story of Neanderthals and humans, or if a story of a history of what we would call population structure. So it's not a single population that is, you know, randomly mating, but you have geographic structure, but that geographic structure is connected by ongoing migration or ongoing what we call gene flow between the resident populations of the time. They're connected. You know, you might have some periods of fragmentation, but you have also these periods of merging, of coalescence, of mixing. And we found that a model where you include ongoing migration between at least two, possibly more populations across the continent, that does a better job of explaining the patterns of genetic variation that we see in not just African populations today, but populations around the world, given that we all share that common history, because this is prior to the expansion of humans around the globe.
So here, as I'm listening to you, Aaron, explain your research, what I'm hearing is we had this ghost population that helped explain a mystery in our human evolution, and you looked at human social interaction and the lack of isolation and how populations would mate and meet and come together and then fall apart, and how that could help explain, without any ghost population, our human evolution and where we all are today and how we all go back to the same ancestral lineage.
Yeah, yeah. And so what you find is you have, probably that's, in hindsight, not that surprising. You have people living across a large geographic range, but they're connected.
Well, there might be mountains between us, but sooner or later, somebody's going to climb that mountain and make it to the other side. There might be lakes or oceans between us, but somebody's going to sail them and go see who's over
or
there.
There are a lot of generations that over this time period. We're not talking just a handful of generations. These are hundreds of thousands of years. This is many thousands of generations. And people can move incredible distances over this amount of time. And so it's really not surprising that we would have connection.
How come nobody thought
individuals?
Of this before you, Aaron Ragsdale?
Well, people have thought about this.
But you
people
were able
have,
to look at the science
we're
and
just
substantiate
now,
it.
We're just now getting the genetic data to test these models.
Yeah, and so what has the reaction been like so far of your research, Aaron?
I think it's been well accepted. Yeah. I think there have been follow-up studies that have used genetic data from different populations that have corroborated these findings. And I think it's been fairly well accepted among other fields as well, like paleoanthropology and among archaeologists. You find there's kind of remember what I was talking about, these multiple lines of evidence. Mm-hmm. You have the emerging of technologies like stoneworking technologies and tools that look like they also, you had this cultural evolution and technological evolution that also was kind of in concert, where you looked at different places across the continent and you would find kind of concurrent evolution of technological advances, like techniques for flaking a stone or something like
everything
that.
Everything
right?
through the and it, and different sciences seems to substantiate the research and your findings in your work.
Yeah, you had cultural connections, social connections, technological art connections, and also genetic connections, I think.
What's it like to change science, as you know, there? It's kind of, I mean, the scientific understanding, and you are now a part of our evolving understanding of human evolution. That's got to be a little weird, right?
Well, it's incredibly exciting to be in this field, and it's not like I wouldn't go as far to say as we're coming along and busting open the field or something like that. This is in concert with a lot of different collaborators and colleagues across population genetics, across paleoanthropology, It's kind of an ongoing dialogue among a lot of different researchers on this topic, and kind of collectively coming to a better understanding of our own evolutionary history.
So what's next in this dialogue? We'll ask when we continue with our guest, Aaron Ragsdale, assistant professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison, taking a look at his research and how it's changing our understanding of human evolution. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on WPR News. Larry's back tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in today. And tomorrow on this show, the blood test that is identifying Alzheimer's disease, how to best talk to someone who has dementia, and also how to take the best care of your mouth, all coming up tomorrow starting at 11 with Larry on the Larry Mueller Show. But right now, we're talking to Aaron Ragsdale, assistant professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison. His research is helping to evolve what we understand of human evolution and how interconnected each and every one of us actually are if you go back far enough. And one of those interconnections now includes, as we understand it, thanks to our advancing genetic science, is through Neanderthals, Aaron. And this still kind of blows my mind because it's not what I learned back in science when I was studying science back before, you know, back a long time ago now. So the story of Neanderthals and how we fit into that, share a little bit of that with us.
Yeah, so as I was speaking to you just a few minutes ago, 20 years ago, we didn't know that there was a connection between humans and Neanderthals. So probably many of the listeners, in school, you would learn these were divergent lineages, and they went extinct, and then we outcompeted them or something like that, right?
Right.
And now it seems pretty well. It seems clear that we didn't just replace them, but we did something like absorb them.
Interesting.
And it wasn't a one-off thing. There's relatively recent, just within the last year or two, research that shows that there were probably more than just a single episode of connection. So Neanderthals and humans diverged around 500, 600, 700,000 years ago initially. So that's when their common ancestor was. And then even 5 years ago, we thought that they were completely isolated from humans until around 50 or 60,000 years ago when our own species expanded and moved around the globe, encountered Neanderthals on the way, and absorbed those resident populations into our own. And that's how we would have inherited those genetic components from Neanderthals. Mm-hmm. Instead, it seems that there's been ongoing, it's probably related to climate, to the glaciation cycles, and when regions of the world were amenable for humans to move across them.
When they were forced to move.
Or even just when a desert turned more green and you could cross hundreds of miles instead of being more isolated. So there are climatic events that
the way the world changes defines what our behavior.
And so there would be periods when humans could expand outside of Homo sapiens could expand outside of Africa, and then whenever they did that, they would find other hominin. Or
human-like populations,
including Neanderthals, including Denisovans. If you've heard that name, that's a sister branch to Neanderthals that lived in East Asia.
So instead of a common ancestor with Neanderthals, we're talking common ancestors, and that number may range.
Well, you have, instead of isolation for many hundreds of thousands of years, you probably just kind of like this story that we were telling within Africa, within our own species of movement and connection. It's probably a very similar story with Neanderthals. It looks like Neanderthals actually inherited 5 or 10% of human DNA.
Interesting.
A couple hundred thousand years ago from a human early Homo sapiens population that left Africa, didn't actually establish there as they're not the ancestors of humans living outside of Africa today, but they were absorbed by Neanderthal populations. And so if you look at Neanderthal DNA, you kind of find the mirror image. We have some of the Neanderthal DNA from us absorbing some of those populations, and the vice versa. Neanderthals, if you were to sequence them,
they
would have
us.
some human DNA from absorbing some of those early excursions outside of Africa. And this probably happened not just once, not just twice, but probably whenever there is the opportunity for people to move, because that's what people do.
Periods of isolation, periods of connection, mm-hmm. and over hundreds of thousands of years, this could have happened any number of hundreds of times.
Could have happened many times. And so you get this, the analogy that a lot of people like to use is one of a braided stream. So you have kind of this, if you think about evolution of as a flowing of water, you have a braided stream where you have splits mm-hmm. in the waterway that come back together and split mm-hmm. again and come back together. And every time you have those comings together, you have mixture and then you split again. And so genetics get shuffled around during those periods. And then you can kind of reconstruct the events of when those mixtures happen by looking at the DNA of people living today.
Thinking of our evolution like a roiling river that goes into tributaries and separates and reconnects. And mm-hmm. when it does, it's a little bit different than when it first split off. And mm-hmm. it's still moving today. David and Shorewood emailed to ask if the genetic material from the early finds are adequate to place them relative to each other. Or is that really old artifact still a mystery? Are there genetic materials from the early finds that are adequate to place them relative to each other?
If I understand, so early finds meaning the older fossils. So
sure.
so there's probably a lot of people have heard of the ancient DNA revolution, where we're able to now essentially drill bones and get DNA from people who lived hundreds, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of years ago. That depends a lot on the conditions that the fossil was stored in or in the ground. You know, mm-hmm. cooler, drier climates are going to preserve DNA much better than hotter climates or wetter climates. And so it's we don't, and you can imagine why that's a challenge within the African continent, because it's a hotter place
yeah.
than, you know, the Tibetan Plateau or Northern Europe, where we've been able to get DNA from Neanderthals that lived 50 to 100,000 years ago. In Africa, we don't have ancient DNA beyond a few thousand years.
So that would be a challenge.
So it's challenging. So even though we have some fossils that we would really love DNA from them, there's just no DNA. It's all been degraded due to the conditions that the fossils were in.
Aaron Rex,
I don't know if that answers the question.
it helps me understand your work, but where does your work go from here? What questions do you still have about our evolution, and where will your work take you next?
Yeah, so this is, well, there are a lot of ways.
You got a lot of questions.
Yeah, I've got a lot of questions. Whenever you do this, you kind of uncover more questions than as you answer.
Yeah.
I'd really love to be able. So what we have when we're talking about models of early evolution, these are really quite cartoonish. Like they're very, we're trying to peer way into the distant past. So we've only been really able to say like very blocky, we don't have a very clear picture of exactly when and exactly where individuals lived. I would love to merge the genetic analyses with stuff like climate reconstruction.
Ooh.
To try to actually pinpoint where the ranges of people might have been over different times and try to map the actual genetic history onto a geography.
Interesting.
That would be really exciting, quite challenging.
Yeah.
These models also raise questions about what does trait evolution look like? What does phenotypic evolution look like among the different competing models?
When you say phenotypic.
Yeah, like just, our genomes are encoding everything that makes up us, our bodies, our, you know, our physiology.
Okay.
And so if you think about how genes are related to, I don't know, metabolism, whatever physiological trait you're looking at, you can ask how does evolution of these physiological traits depend on what we would call the demographic model that you've hypothesized or inferred, the evolutionary model that you've inferred. And so those are trying to understand how natural selection, how
climate change, trade,
geography, population density and movement and people,
our physiology,
how that all relates to.
You're trying to solve it all, Aaron.
Well, little bits and pieces of it.
I hope you can join us again and share your work with us. And I thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Aaron Ragsdale, Assistant Professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison. And again, thank him for joining us. Want to thank our team for making it all so much fun and so easy today. Our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, our technical director extraordinaire, Jeff Robbins, and of course, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. Larry Mueller returns tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn sitting in for him today, and you're listening to WPR News.